So I hope everyone enjoys this brief intermission in our day of practice.
Okay. When Chris asked me to be Jeff Folksonine's assistant, I didn't think it would be giving a talk. I thought maybe I'd be serving him tea or something. So let's see. I guess what brings me to this practice is it's simplicity, and we've talked about this before. The idea that you just return to before thinking mind. You see the truth of a situation, and then find the fitting function and respond out of that. And that's, you know, to me that's very simple. Not necessarily easy. And you know, I've learned that in the Kangan practice. Just going through those steps in a simple Kangan can be difficult at times. I think the teachers can attest to, I don't think I've actually gotten anyone on the first try yet. So, you know, it's always kind of go off and let it sit for a day or two and then, or a week, and come back and then maybe have an aha moment. And that, you know, lines up pretty well with life for me. Let's see. So anyway, a couple of weeks ago, my wife and I went down to visit my mother-in-law to celebrate her birthday. And while we were traveling down there, she became ill, and by the time we got there, she was in hospital. It turns out that you know, she's got meds that she takes, and she just decided, I guess, to not take them. And so, you know, we went directly to the hospital. And so she spent a couple of days there, you know, they got her stabilized, and the good news is she's doing fine. And so, you know, we were able to go on and have the birthday celebrations, and you know, it was a good time. But after the celebration, you know, we were sitting and just chatting, and as we are all kind of wont to do, she was chastising herself for, putting yourself through this and putting the family through this. And so, you know, I was with her and, you know, offered comforting words and so forth. But then on the plane back, I was thinking about it, and I was just kind of thinking about it from a Zen point of view. And yeah, they were just words, you know. You know, they were comforting words, but still. You know, so I started thinking about it in terms of the steps. And it occurred to me that, you know, perhaps a more helpful response in that situation for me would have been to serve her tea. She loves tea. She likes her afternoon cup of tea, and you know, her family's busy, so they don't often indulge her in this practice. And it occurred to me that possibly would have been a more helpful response in that situation. It then occurred to me that, like a Kangan, I was always about a day late. that's the wonderful thing about this practice, is that you know, you get to do it again, you know, moment by moment. We have the opportunity to go to before thinking mind and see the truth and then respond accordingly. So that's my talk.
That was very good. Very good. Thank you. So I was having this reflection on the practice we're doing and how, what changes over time as we practice over time. Some of us here have been practicing long, long time. What would characterize perhaps the effect of being a Zen practitioner, of doing doing Zen. And this really interesting metaphor came along of how it is that our experience, how we hold our experience, how we hold the experience that comes to us day to day, or maybe more intense, you know, shocking experience. So in the extreme, some people who really have a very strong, maybe a sort of a almost a death grip, a grasp on the conditions of their life, their experience becomes, and particularly some that are threatening, becomes like a line etched in stone. This is like descriptive of trauma, real trauma, or injury, a wound, something, you know, some kind of blow up. But it's like a line etched in stone, and it's very hard to have that resolve, or in some way, you know, become less indelible in our experience. I mean, certainly have this experience with clients, some of my clients. You know, there something happened to them, particularly when they're young, that just is a line etched in stone, and they really can't, it's completely limiting, and it defines their life to some degree. It's really sad. They don't have the practice of, you know, necessarily, of just sitting quietly with themselves, with their experience as we do, just sitting quietly. So, it's all, you know, therapy has its effect, but that line seems to remain. Some people I've worked with, it remains year after year, and it's very frustrating. You know, I suggest that people do a little mindfulness practice, or, you know, find some way to calmly soothe themselves just as a routine, as part of their experience day to day. So they have a contrast between living with that indelible line. But as we practice, and actually some people I work with are meditators, they're kind of drawn to my therapy practice because I'm a Zen guy, and they assume I'm familiar with mindfulness. These people have their experiences, I mean, good and bad can happen, but for some reason, because they have that capacity to sort of sit and simply, as you're saying, be with themselves, then their experience becomes more like a line drawn in sand. You know, other things come, the wind comes. Anyway, a line drawn in sand, it's not a line etched in stone anymore. And there's a certain beginning sort of spaciousness to it. Now I can see in my own experience how that happens, that in truth, you know, I mean, many things have happened to me, but I would even say with my own cancer and going through that, I think that could have very well have been a line etched in stone and terrifying. And I was given a 50% chance of surviving. That's terrifying. But, I mean, I am on the other side of it, and, you know, cancer can always recur. But it wasn't a line etched in stone for me. It was more like etched in sand, and it's sort of fading as the years have gone by. In 3-4 years, I would say cancer-free. But I could imagine with my practice, if I really apply myself, I might come to the point where my experience then becomes like a line drawn in water. It doesn't remain. It's not in any way indelible. It just, in some way, there's an openness, an ability to be with whatever comes along. And because I have this, you know, developed sense of just resting with just how it is just now. And this is what we're doing in this retreat, and when we practice at home, we don't have a lot of say in what comes along in our mind, or what, you know, what comes along in our day that then we go and have our sitting, and it's very current. But our relation to it can be like a line drawn in water. There's always more. Everything's kind of impermanent, changing like that. Like a line drawn in water. And what I'm recalling right now with Zen Master Sung San, when Sihoi Liao, the Korean, very, very fine Zen master that Sung Sanim trained, Kun Sanim, I think they call it, right? Zen Master Sung San. He had a lot invested in Sihoi. He was hoping, I think, that because Sihoi is Korean, he would be a wonderful transmission of Sung San's teaching in the Korean community as well as in America. I mean, Sihoi is an American, lived, you know, grew up in California, but, and it was an enormous shock when Sihoi, I mean, suddenly died, just died of a heart attack out of nowhere. And I wasn't there, but my understanding from some other monks that I know that lived there in Korea with Sung San at that time, that actually we have a koan about this grandmother who's weeping uncontrollably, something she, you know, her child or her granddaughter, something tragic happened, and she was just completely overwhelmed with the pain of it, and she let that really come forward and come through. But the implication is that there's no holding back with our experience, and if we're not holding back, if we're not sort of, you know, pushing it away or in some way adjusting what is naturally occurring, those experiences become like a line drawn in water. Or maybe, as I was saying with Zen Master Sung San, it seemed like it was a line drawn in air that he actually regained his I don't know, just his radiance, what he was before that, how he was so alive to us all and very, you know, light-hearted, and that he actually returned to that after that tragedy, and that he has this mind, that this capacity for, and anything can pass through. And I think what's instructive about that, and counter to our usual way of being, without having any kind of a practice, counter to our usual way of being, is it will take certain experiences or impressions, maybe of others, of us, and begin to define kind of a rigid sense of ourselves and the limits of that. And we just make this line drawn in stone for ourselves. And it's our own doing. And so how do we undo it? Like this, we sit. And there's no predicting what will come in our experience sitting here, what memories or what worries or self-criticism or whatever might come along. We can just allow it to come and pass through. In some traditions it's called the self-liberation of thought, that our thoughts and feelings actually dissolve of themselves. We can hang on and grasp them further and kind of go over it again and again, but of itself, there's some sense of it just dissolving of itself, and the next fresh thing comes, the next fresh thing. So, I mean, it's very dangerous to describe what our meditation practice might be, but I'm just indicating, you know, there's a journey, I think, that we all experience in the shift of how we cope with life, cope with, you know, challenges, and that our practice is so just close to the core of our day-to-day. It's very intimate. And we have this capacity to be spacious and allow whatever comes to just come and go, come through. So if you had served her tea instead of reassuring her, do you think it would have maybe encouraged her to just like move on, it's over, you don't have to feel guilty?
Don't know.
Hard to tell. But it's an alternative that you occurred to you, right? Mm-hmm. From your own practice experience. So that's enough. I just wanted to touch on that. And we're going to have a nice walk out in a beautiful sunny day today. So let's get ready and meet outside.